to start general relativity, I have some four manifold M. Because I'm going to be talking often about the Hamiltonian theory, often this is going to be of the form of some three manifold cross R, where R is time. And conventionally, the way that general relativity is written, there is a metric. And I assume here that everybody has studied general relativity, so everybody knows this. There's a metric, GAV. And as a result of the metric, there's a covariant derivative, say dA dB equals del A dB plus gamma ABC dC. There's a curvature, RABCD. And the Einstein equations are RAB minus 1/2 GAB, this is just a set notation, minus 1/2 GAB, the cosmological constant, is equal to 8 pi Newton's constant times the energy momentum tensor. Okay, and this thing here is sometimes called the Einstein tensor GAB. Okay, everybody fine? Now, this can be derived from a variational principle, and tell me if this is something that you haven't seen. So those of you who take the general relativity, but not, you may not have seen an action principle. Is that right? Okay. So I'm going to tell you what the action principle is, and I'm going to sketch the arguments, and these are definitely to be checked. Okay. I'm not going to go all the arguments on the blackboard. Okay. The action is the integral over the four manifold of the determinant of minus g of the metric times GAB times the Ricci scalar RAB minus 2 lambda. Actually, I'm going to get in trouble if I write it that way, so let me write it this way. Minus 2 lambda. plus the, let me just write it as the Lagrangian for matter. So that's the way the action principle is conventionally written. And conventionally, in this part here, which is the gravity part, we put the 1 over 8 pi Newton's constant there. And now we do the variational principle, that is, we set delta S equal to 0. By the way, there are some cute stories about this. Einstein, there's a very long, cute story about how Einstein took a long time to write down the right field equation and chickened out. Didn't understand the meaning of diffeomorphism invariance, et cetera, wrote down the wrong field equation, studied it for 3 or 4 years with a bunch of people. Meanwhile, and I just learned some of this history for the book that I'm writing. Meanwhile, a bunch of people like Hilbert and Einstein were trying to construct unified field theories. Even before general relativity was written down, they were trying to be unified with electromagnetism. And Hilbert invented an action principle for the wrong theory that Einstein was studying, which was inconsistent. And then Einstein wrote a paper in which he said, no, these are the right field equations. I don't even know how to write down the wrong equation, because Einstein talked himself, he got flipped out by the implications of diffeomorphism invariance, because there was gauge invariance and equations of motion had three functions in them, and he didn't understand that. So he talked himself into the wrong conclusion, which is that the right theory cannot be diffeomorphism invariant. So he wrote down some random combinations of derivatives of the metric that whose main feature was that it was not diffeomorphism invariant. And he was studying that. for 3 or 4 years. And, you know, he calculated the precession of perihelion of Mercury, and it came out, it was somebody else did with him, and it came out wrong. Various other things, gravitational waves. It was a big mess, but Hilbert was a really powerful mathematician, so he managed to write down an action principle for the wrong, inconsistent theory. And then Einstein realized his mistake under the prodding of his friend Grossman, I think, who figured out what diffeomorphism variance was a good thing. And he submitted a paper with the right field equation in it. And Hilbert, in proof of his own paper, changed his paper so that he had the action principle for the right equations. And ever since then, there was a controversy because Hilbert's paper had been submitted and accepted before Einstein's paper. So people for a long time believed it was actually Einstein, Hilbert, who got the equations right for the first time. It was only when people recently were going through the archives and they found the real stuff with the real dates on them, and they found that Hilbert had changed it, had completely changed his paper in the proofs. So anyway, so this is sometimes called the Einstein-Hilbert action, but it's for that reason. But anyway, and it also turns out that Hilbert's total interest in it was not so much general relativity as he had an idea about writing a unified field theory with electromagnetism. Okay, so how do you take this variation? Well, so there's three parts. Okay. There's, first of all, you need to know, and these are things you need to check, the variation, and the easiest thing to do is to check by varying by the metric with its native downstairs indices. And boy, I'm going to get things back. I realize I didn't come prepared to do this. But this is, I believe, -1/2 GAB with upstairs indices. So this is to be checked.
Is it minus the root of minus G?
Yes. And you probably know the exact answer. You thought
there's no minus.
There's no minus here, so the minus is here. Right. Then there's a delta G AB, delta G CD, and that has a minus, which has delta delta plus delta delta AB CD AB DC, like that. And from that, you get that delta S, this part works out very nicely, works out like square root of minus G, delta G, this is another way to write it, GAB times the Einstein tensor GAB. So you get that nicely. And then there's a big mess, which comes from varying inside the R. So then there's a big mess, which is plus, let me put the square root of minus G outside, GAB times the variation inside the RAB. And that's a big mess, but ultimately is zero, up to possible boundary terms. So that's something that this gives you, zero up to boundary terms, is something to check. And then finally, you define that the energy momentum tensor is related to 1 over square root of g, the variation of the integral of square root of g, the matter action, by g upper AB. And by putting all of this together, you get the GAB, and the -1/2 GAB lambda comes for free is equal to 8 pi G TAB. Okay, so there's a lot to check there, But I want to leave it as an exercise. And if you have trouble with it, it's in Wall's book. It's the clearest place I know is in Wall's book, in one of the appendices. It's also in Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler.
Sorry, I'm going mad. Is there any one half there for the cosmology? I keep forgetting.
You're right. I keep forgetting, but I don't think so. I think there's a two in the action, so that there's not a one half there. You're right. You're right. Thank you. There's a certain course at Imperial College where if you ever take it, this is one of the two exam questions every year on that course. But it's not the course taught by Jeff.
That's not true.
What do you mean that's not true?
It's not in the GR course.
No, it's not in the GR course. Anyway, that's an inside joke.
It's a long story.
Okay. Anyway. And we'll come to the other exam problem in that course, just in case some of you end up on the Imperial College for some reason. Okay. Now, this is one of the reasons why I'm not doing this on the blackboard, is that almost every step here is ugly and involves worrying about determinants, inverses, stuff like that, which is messy. Okay. And because of that, very quickly, people invented easier ways to express Einstein's equations. And the way to do it is to introduce Cartan notation, okay, or equivalently what are called, these are called sometimes frame fields. Some people call them verbines to impress people that you know a foreign language. And here's the basic idea. The basic idea is that the principle of equivalence says that you can always go into a freely falling frame, and in the freely falling frame, the laws of special relativity are true. Now, what that means practically is that there's always, if you go into the freely falling frame, you can always find a clock, which is a good clock for doing special relativistic physics, and three perpendicular rulers, which give you a frame of reference. So the idea of Cartan is to refer all quantities explicitly to the frame of reference. Another way to say it, that's too confusing. Let me just leave that there. So the idea is that you have four one-form fields. That says that they're one-form fields, and I need another index, and this is one of these games, what did I choose from the notes? I'm going to call them mu. And mu labels 0, 1, 2, 3, just labels these one-form fields. And the idea is that we pick these so that they're orthonormal in terms of the metric. So given the metric, we require that these are orthonormal, and that means that GAB, EANU, EB nu is ones and zeros, and in the case that the signature is Minkowskian, there's a minus one. So for Minkowskian signature, it has that form.
So the AB are space-time indices.
The AB are space-time indices, and the mu nu, and this is backwards in some books and so forth. But I'm going to do it this way, because I'm using consistently, I'm following basically Wald's notation. with a lowercase a, b, or space-time indices.
So when you do this move, you must introduce a handedness, right? Because these new labels first.
This definitely introduces a handedness. Yes. Good. Thank you.
Okay. This is more than. The free falling frame is more than these. People always say this is the free falling
frame.
Well, it's a lot more than that. I mean, it means connection being zero, means the derivative, some derivatives of the connection.
That's fair. But this is part of the specification. Yeah. The other way to say it, I can just say if you this is of course redundant. There's an ambiguity because given frame fields that give you a good inertial frame, there's a Lorentz group worth of other Lorentz frames, so that under a Lorentz transformation. Let's see. I'm a little screwed here. I'm going to move over. Under a Lorentz transformation, these should mix up. I'm probably erasing things I'm going to want later, but that's okay. So there can be a Lorentz transformation by which these e's go to some other e's, e prime a's, which are still one forms, which are given by Lorentz transformation e nu a of the old ones. Okay. But this is a Lorentz transformation, and how you show that is you require that this also be, that the new frame fields also be orthonormal in terms of the metric. And if you plug this equation into here, you discover the condition of a Lorentz transformation, that lambda mu nu, lambda, say, alpha beta, eta mu beta is equal to eta mu alpha. And this tells you that the lambdas live in the group SO31, which is the Lorentz transformations. So there's a Lorentz group worth of possible frame fields at each point. And they all satisfy this equation with a single metric. So you're introducing an ambiguity in the description when you refer physical quantities to the frame fields. So what I mean by refer physical quantities to the frame fields is that if I have some vector field, say WA, instead I can define quantity W mu, which is the contraction of WA with these one-form fields. And then, rather than talking about a vector field, I talk about the components of the vector field in this particular reference frame given by these four orthogonal frame fields. And under the Lorentz transformation, W mu, you can work out, goes to W mu prime, W prime mu, which is lambda mu mu W mu. So the idea is you refer quantities of interest like vector fields. Instead of talking about them as vector fields on the manifold, you talk about them in terms of what their components would be measured in terms of this orthonormal frame. And that's loose. I think it's referred to as Cartan's method or Cartan's notation. Okay. Now, one way to think about what a metric is that if there wasn't any metric and you're just in the tangent space of vector fields at a point, there's a full general linear symmetry. So the symmetry of just vectors, okay, at a point without a metric is just GL4. This is where real space GL4 are. If you don't know anything else and you just have a vector space and vectors in it, you can make any linear transformation on it and it's a symmetry. Okay. If you have a metric, then of those general linear transformations, there are special ones which are Lorentz transformations which preserve that metric. And so you can think of a metric as a symmetry breaking. Where you break the GL4R to the Lorentz group, which is SL13. I mean, these things apply in any dimension. But it's an interesting way and a useful way to think about the metric. What a metric is some field which comes along and breaks a local symmetry, because this is happening at each point in space-time. From the general case, if there were no metric, where it would just be any general linear transformation, to the Lorentz transformations which preserve that metric.
But it is true in the sense of field theory, spontaneous symmetry breaking.
That's a very deep and interesting question, and I'll postpone it. I mean, I believe the answer is yes, and that's part of what the mathematics I'm developing is about. Okay. Let me use this board, and there's just some other features of this. One of them is that there is the inverse frame fields. So these are some vector fields. They have the same notation, but the indices are reversed. So these are vector fields labeled by mu, and they are defined to be inverse to the original ones, which are one forms, defined by this equation. So this defines them. That I take the contraction of the vector field with the one form, which gives me a number for each of the four of them, and I get ones or zeros. And so these objects are used to expand, to do the opposite thing, to expand one form. So if I have a one form omega A, I can instead write that in terms of omega mu, which is omega A EA mu. So I can resolve components and talk about components of one forms. And then what's very beautiful, let's see, we will come back, I promise you we will come back to this theory. Actually, why not? Let's save the blackboard. Let's just hide that away and save it. Is that if you have the frame fields, you can reconstruct the metric. And the idea is the following, that if I have, say, VAWB, the inner product between two vector fields, V and W, given with the metric, I want that to be the same thing as taking the contraction in the frame of reference. So this is the components referred to the frame of reference, and this is the components referred to the frame of reference, and this is the metric in just Minkowski spacetime. So this is a kind of statement of the equivalence principle. And if you flesh that through, that tells you that G, you can basically invert the relationship here between the G's and the E's, and write G in terms of the two one-form fields. And this is a tensor. These are each one-form, so implicitly there's a tensor product there. So this tells you that if you know the frame fields, you know the metric. On the other hand, if going the reverse way, if you know the metric, you know the frame fields, but only up to Lorentz transformations. Because two frame fields, two sets of frame fields that differ by Lorentz transformations are equivalent. Now, in the language where everything is referred to the indices in the frame of reference, we can talk about covariant derivatives also. And so there's a new notion of a covariant derivative, which is defined in the following way. I want to make sense of a covariant derivative in the eighth direction of some, not some vector field, but the components of the vector field in the local frames of reference. And let me emphasize that we do this at each point in space and time. And when we do it at each point in space and time, let me emphasize that I'm free to make these Lorentz transformations separately at each point of space and time. Because the equivalence principle says I can always locally go into a local frame of reference. But which local frame of reference I use, I can make the gauge transformation, or I'm already calling it a gauge transformation, Lorentz transformation locally. So what emerges is that it is as if the Lorentz transformations are exactly like a Yang-Mills gauge group. So Lorentz transformations are local and are just like a Yang-Mills gauge group. And that's the key insight that makes everything that's going to follow happen. That we can think of the covariant derivative in space-time as like a Yang-Mills covariant derivative, but where the gauge group is not SU2, it's the Lorentz group. So if I go ahead and define a connection or a gauge field, I would write this as dA v mu. And then I want some gauge field, which I might call AA mu nu v nu. But to avoid confusion with what's coming, I'm going to call that omega, and also for consistency with the notation that people used before they realized how cool this is and that it really was just a gauge field. And so this defines something that's called the spin connection. And I'm going to write down some of its properties. So we think of this as like a Yang-Mills field, but a Yang-Mills field for the local frame rotations, which are, in the case of space-time, the Lorentz group.
Why is it called spin connection?
You'll see. That's a good question. But because some version of this was originally developed to tell spinners how to parallel transport. No, that's a mis- the spin torsion thing came later. Okay. But I mean, one place this comes from is how would you think about how spin is transformed. But I'm not going to go there today. Okay. Well, so a thing that you certainly would like is, since we have a metric on the mu and nu indices, there is a metric, so we can raise and lower with the mu and nu indices. We also have to define dA, say, the components of a one-form. Oops, instead of calling something else, or I'll get in trouble. Phi mu, del A, phi mu, minus omega A, mu, nu, phi nu. And I'm there really is just one object, omega A mu nu, and when I do this, I'm now letting myself raise and lower indices with the eta. So I'm raising, I allow myself to raise and lower frame indices with the eta mu nu. Okay? Now, I also would like it to be true that the covariant derivative on a contraction like that is just the ordinary derivative, because the contraction should be a scalar. The contraction of the vector with the one form should be a scalar, and the covariant derivative of a scalar is an ordinary derivative. And that tells me that omega A mu nu is anti-symmetric. This is something you can check. It's anti-symmetric, and therefore it's valued in the Lie algebra that generates the orthogonal transformations. Remember, anti-symmetric matrices generate orthogonal transformations. So therefore, this thing can be thought of as living in the anti-symmetric matrices. Which generate the Lie algebra of SO 1, 3. Okay. Now, am I going too fast, too slow? Is this okay? Okay. Okay. So these are a different kind of covariant derivative. But
covariant derivatives with respect to the
No, because the derivative is always a derivative in the in some direction in the manifold. So this is always a manifold index. I'm not going to get involved in that becoming a frame field index, because I'm always taking a derivative of functions on the manifold. One can invent any kind of notation one wants, but it's not. It's neither pretty nor useful to do that, so I'm not going to do that. Okay. Now, how do the E's themselves transform? The E's have one index of each kind. So if I take a covariant derivative by, say, an E, then that will be an object like this. I think minus is conventional. Help me with the conventional indices here. A, mu, nu, E, B, nu. Okay. Because this is a mixed object, you have to correct the transformation properties on both the space-time index, which is done here, and on the internal. When I say internal, that's how we refer, we mean indices refer to the local frame of reference.
So that's the Christoffel connection.
If I assume that this is the Christoffel connection, then it is the Christoffel connection. I don't have to assume that. Okay, it's some connection. Okay. Now, if I remember that we want the frame field to be metric compatible, I'm sorry, the connection, if we assume that the connection is metric compatible, which is an assumption, then we can invert this, and we can discover that this should be zero, and that tells us that we can write omega, and I'm not going to write the whole thing for the moment, but you can invert this with the E's and write this, I guess I will, I'll start it out, V E, nu, let's see, B nu del A, I'm sorry, U E B nu. So there's a term like this. There's, and then there's a term like lambda A B C B C nu B B. So this is nu and this is mu. So you can invert that and express the omega as a function of the E's and its derivatives and these connection coefficients, which are the standard covariant derivative connection coefficients. Okay. So in the end, everybody is related. These new covariant derivatives are related to the old covariant derivatives. Everybody here? Okay. It turns out that if I use this notation, there's a very nice way to write the Einstein equations and write the action principle for the Einstein equations. And that's why I'm introducing it. I need to introduce one more thing, which is I need to introduce the F. If I treat omega like a Yang-Mills, see, this is just like I would be treating it if it were a Yang-Mills connection, and this were some index in some internal space that I had a symmetry, in which the symmetry happens to be Lorentz group. And that's what the interpretation allows, because when I refer things to the frame fields, it's as if I have some internal symmetry, which is just rotating the frame field indices. So it makes sense to write an FAB mu nu, which is d omega mu nu AB plus, and it's really the same equation. So I'll write it, and then I'll explain why I claim it's the same equation. Omega A wedge omega B mu lambda lambda nu is a definition of the field strain. What I mean by it's the same equation is let me have some generators, tau mu nu equals minus tau mu nu, and these are just the anti-symmetric matrices. These are just generators for the anti-symmetric matrices. And then I can write omega A as living in the anti-symmetric matrices as omega A mu nu tau mu nu. So the omega A, if I write it without indices, are four-dimensional anti-symmetric matrices, every single one of them. Okay, there are four-dimensional anti-symmetric matrices. And then I can just write F, which is a two-form valued in the anti-symmetric matrices, which is d omega plus the commutator of omega, let me call it d omega AB, the commutator of omega A, omega B. So it's just like a Yang-Mills connection. Or sorry, the Yang-Mills field strain. Oops. It's amazing how indestructible those things are. Okay. Okay. And then it's something that you can check that when all of this is satisfied, so when we have that equation, okay, then if I take FAB mu nu and I get rid of these indices in the frame fields in terms of the using the frame fields to transform to objects that are all space-time indices, this is actually the Riemann curvature tensor, just in different language. Okay. All these things are things to check, and they're all in walls, and they're in Misnethor and Wheeler, and I think they're in just about every general activity book. Okay. Now I'm going to use them. So any questions? Okay. So some gentleman named Palatini had a really good idea. And actually, I don't know anything about the history of this or how far this goes back. But Palatini said, let's consider the following action principle. An action in general relativity should be a four-form. And let me try to make something pretty, like the theories we've been discussing so far. Pretty means polynomial. So what we can make that's polynomial? Well, we have the f. So I want to make an action which is a function of the e's and the omegas. And I want it to be invariant under my local frame rotations. And I want it to be diffeomorphism invariant, and I want it to be pretty. So I have the e's are one forms, the omegas are one forms, but they're not, they don't transform nicely. They're like Yang-Mills fields. So I need to put them inside of a field strength to make them transform nicely, which is an f. And so I can have an f with some indices mu nu. And then I need, that's a two form, and I need two more things. So I can take an e, wedge an E, wedge an F, okay, and some indices lambda sigma. And then I have to tie up those Lorentz or Frankfield indices. Okay. Now, there's two ways I can tie them up. I can tie them up directly like this. If I do that, I have an object which is odd parity, because the f is even, each e is odd, it's a vector or one form, but the two of them are even, but the wedge is odd. The wedges are odd. So if I do that, I have something which is odd parity. So what people normally do is go alpha beta and tie them up with an alpha beta with a four-index anti-symmetric symbol.
So what happens with the other term? Forget about the parity. What is it?
I'll speak that as an exercise. It's interesting. It exists. You can throw it in.
It's not a service term.
No.
What's wrong with the parity?
What?
What is wrong with the parity?
It's odd. Then the action changes sign under parity. And since general relativity is, there's no sign of anything parity odd in it from the field equation, so you might want to start with something parity even. Okay. So that's one term you can write. The other term that you can write is a term with four e's. So you can go e wedge e wedge e wedge e alpha beta gamma delta, and tie it up with an alpha beta gamma delta with an epsilon. And then you can look at F wedge F terms. And you can tie them up two ways, mu nu, or the other way, alpha beta gamma delta, epsilon alpha beta gamma delta. And that's what you can do, which is polynomial.
Those set terms are not going to give you GR.
These are both related to topological invariance.
Yes,
yeah, so and I'm going to ignore these, actually. Just like I did for the DF theory, I'm going to
just...
They're not really... The reason why they're not high derivative terms is in the wedge, the time derivatives, the derivatives are in the wedge, so you only get one time derivative in each one of them. So there's actually not high order in time derivatives.
No, but it's quadratic in the region.
Yes, but it's not. It's always a time derivative with a space derivative.
It's a component.
Yeah, yeah. These are related to, one is the Pontryagin and one is the other. But I'm not for the moment, we can easily include them, but just for simplicity, for the same reason I dropped it out before, I'm going to drop it out for the moment. Okay? Let me notice that this, so if I write things out in components, there's an epsilon ABCD that's writing out the wedge of components, B alpha A, B beta B, F C B into epsilon alpha beta mu nu. This one is just the determinant of E, because if you write it out with the two epsilons, it's just the definition of the determinant up to some number, which is like 1 over 4 factorial. This is like 4 factorial. So I'm going to put a 1 over 4 factorial there. Determinant E is 1 over 4 factorial, epsilon A, B, C, D, epsilon mu, alpha, beta, E, 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 E. And determinant of E, you can convince yourself, because the metric is related to the square of E, and this is true as a matrix product, then this is related to the square root of the determinant of G, A, B. So this term is the term that we already know is the term that gives the cosmological constant. And hence, I'm going to give this a coefficient minus 2 lambda. And then we have this term to deal with. Okay. Now, the field equations are much simpler. Because there's no inverse, there's nothing, there's no determinant. And let me just worry about this term here. So let me take the variation of the integral of epsilon A, B, C, D. Well, I can write it just in terms of forms just as easily. E alpha wedge E beta wedge F mu nu. Epsilon alpha beta mu. And there are two terms in the variation. This is a function. Now, notice something very different about this. The original action principle up there, R was a function of the Christoffel connection, which itself is a function of derivatives of G. So the whole thing is a big pile of derivatives of G. This is a function separately of E and omega, considered free, each of them free, having nothing to do with each other. Okay? So when I vary the E, and it's very easy because it's just an E outside of here. So that's the integral, and there's twice E alpha wedge, I'm sorry, twice delta E. So varying this one plus varying this one, the signs are right, so it's just twice varying the first one. So then you get here E beta wedge F mu nu epsilon alpha beta mu nu. So that's all you get from that. And then from this, I have to vary the omega inside the F. So I get the E wedge the E alpha beta. And then when I vary the omega, I remember that there's a derivative term and there's a term which is quadratic in omega. So I get a term that goes like d, the variation of omega, mu mu, and then a term that goes like the variation of omega wedge omega.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. Shouldn't it be minus lambda determinant d?
I'm just doing this term.
Yeah, but just in the second term. Yes, Don? 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 Yes.
Thank you.
And the bracket closes for
very good. Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. It tells you that guys are really following. Okay. So I get two equations in motion when I vary the E. So delta of all of that delta E and U, and look at what I get. I get, and I'll write it out, epsilon A, B, C, D, epsilon mu, actually this is alpha, beta, mu, nu. And here I get E, B, beta, F, C, D, mu, nu. And that's equal to zero. And then watch what happens. Again, I'm going to not worry about boundary terms. There are boundary terms if there is a boundary, but I'm not going to worry about them. I integrate by parts this derivative here, which puts it here, and this covariantizes it. Okay. So what I end up getting is d, and there's still the epsilon alpha beta mu nu, and there's an epsilon a b c d. So what I get, let me define something. I'm going to define sigma alpha beta to be e alpha wedge e beta. That's an interesting object we're going to get to know. It's a two-form, which is the E wedge the E. Okay? And then what we get is D sigma alpha beta plus a term in omega wedge sigma alpha gamma beta is equal to zero. So this is like a covariant derivative of the sigma is equal to zero. Okay? And those are the equations of motion. Okay? Everybody follow? I mean, you should check, but this is what happens. Sigma is a two form, so d of it is a three form. Omega is a one form, so omega with sigma is again a three form.
So is that the equation for the omega?
Yeah, this is delta of the action, delta of omega. Okay. Now, those are Einstein's equations. And how do you show that? Okay. So, let me give these guys names. And I think before, let's see, let me just, I'm in Blackboard tell here. Where is my relationship? Oh, there, up there. Okay? So, this equation becomes an equation which relates omegas and E's to derivatives of E's. Okay? And a big ugly thing to check is that this is equivalent if and only if to the equation that I put the check sign next to. That is, omega is E inverse derivative of E plus EE gamma, where the gamma is some G's, and derivative is some G inverses derivatives of G. Okay. Now, there's a nice derivation of that in Wald. It's ugly, it's less ugly the way Wald does it, and I think what I'd like to do is leave it as something to check. It's, I don't know, anyway, even Wald's way, it's kind of a mess, but it's a basic fact and needs to be checked. Let me say in words what it means. What it means is that the equations of motion for omega, treating omega as free in this action, treating omega as an independent variable, the equations of motion that omega satisfy tell you that omega is actually determined by derivatives of E, and it's determined in exactly the way it must be if omega is the spin connection associated with the metric made from E. And it's a very beautiful and important fact, and it suggests a kind of liberation of the omegas. That is, the way that Einstein formulated general relativity, okay, the metric is the physical field, and the Christoffel symbols are slaves to them, are just bunches, are just stand for piles of derivatives of the metric. Okay. The Palatini variational principle suggests that there's another way of looking at it, in which the frame fields here are actually independent degrees of freedom. Well, what we're going to see is that this can be pushed to the point where we really see the theory as a theory of the omegas. And this is a step towards that, but it's half a step. Yes?
So does this equation also say it's torsion free?
Yes. 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 One way to derive it is to write, this is what Wald does, that omega is the Christoffel connection plus possibly a torsion. And then you can show that this equation is just the equation for torsion is zero. Okay, but I decided I didn't want to get into that. That's one way to do that. I think torsion is a vastly overrated concept, so I didn't want to spend half of a lecture introducing it and then killing it off. Okay.
So what happens if you decide to take a Bernstein theory and actually put the plane there?
It's an even bigger mess. It works in the end.
So you cannot just absorb it in the field or anything?
Well, sure you can, because you can always absorb, if you put some function of the scalar field in front of here, you can always absorb it into E's and then do everything and then deabsorb it.
The problem is that if you have a map, then you say you're needing a pattern in the country. But what if you do that, you're putting all the mess inside the map.
Yeah, so that's what you do when you do this. You put all the mess inside the map. Okay. Now, for the other equation, for this equation, you just have to think about, so we have a funny object here, which is epsilon A, B, C, D, okay, epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and I have here an E, B, beta. And what in God's name is that? Well, if you stare at that long enough, you see, well, what is it? It's anti-symmetric in C, D, and gamma and delta. It is a density because the epsilon, the space-time epsilon, is a density. So it's a density. And it's linear, it's a function of the E's. In fact, it's linear in the E's. And if you stare at that long enough, you can convince yourself that that's the same thing as the determinant of E times E C gamma E D delta with the anti-symmetrization up to some factor. And I have forgotten, you're absolutely right. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Good. Gamma delta, yeah, okay. B beta alpha gamma delta. Thank you, thank you. A, C, D. Okay. Up to a coefficient, which is worth checking. And if you plug everything back in, then this equation, let me call this equation the G-Kreft equation, is the same thing as the Einstein equation, GAB times E alpha B. So one of these E's becomes one of these E's, and the other two go and become the metric upper. So what one ends up with is, because of the variation of omega, the G is related by this equation here to the curvature tensor of the connection, which is metric compatible and torsion free. And then you get the Einstein equations being equal to zero. So the variational principle that I wrote up there of Palatini is equivalent to the Einstein equations and gives the Einstein equations.
Should it get Ricci to zero, which is the same thing?
Did I screw up? Maybe I screwed up. Yeah, I think you're right.
It's yeah. The same thing.
It's the same thing in the presence of no metric. Yeah. Let me leave it to check because I want the 10 more minutes. Okay. So all this was known a long time ago. I mean, all this was known, I think, in the 1920s. And after Yang-Mills theory was invented, various people said, well, this whole correspondence makes general relativity looks like a theory of a Yang-Mills theory, of a Yang-Mills field, but where the Yang-Mills field has the group, which is like the local Lorentz transformations, rather than, say, SU2 or SU3. So the idea was around for a long time. In some sense, general relativity is like a Yang-Mills theory. And there were various attempts to really make good at that at the dynamical level and at the quantum level. The idea was also around, which I wrote here, that somehow if you expressed it as more like a Yang-Mills theory, you could see that it's as if you have a Yang-Mills field, and then you have a sigma, which you have an E, sorry, which is like a symmetry breaking field. You didn't have the E, you would not have a frame field at all, and you would be, if you had an engaged field, it would have to have the general linear symmetry, and then somehow you have the E is something like a Higgs field or a symmetry breaking field that breaks you down to Lorentz group, and then you have a gauge field of Lorentz group. And there were a lot of attempts to make good on this. Okay. Now, I set the whole thing up in such a way to illustrate that finally, at least, maybe there's a better thing than we know now, but due to Amitabh Sen and Abhayashtakar, there's actually a beautiful way to take what has just been written and really express general relativity as a gauge theory, and express as a gauge theory closely related to that BF theory, which is why I spent so much time on the BF theory and transcendence theory. And the key point is a structure, at least the key point, I mean, the correspondence exists in all dimensions, but it's sharpest in 3+1. And it exists because of a very special structure that exists, which is called self-duality. And I'm just going to write down what the definitions are, and then I'm going to stop, because I see I just have like 5 or 10 more minutes. And then that's where we're going to take off next time. So before I do that, is there any question? I just want to kind of, I want to say one very simple thing, if that's okay. Do people have 8 minutes more attention? Yeah, okay. Good. Okay. Consider we're in four dimensions, and consider anti-symmetric tensors. Okay. So consider objects T such that T, and I'm just going to be using indices in some tangent space, so they're anti-symmetric T mu nu is minus T mu nu. So they're like Maxwell fields, like Maxwell field strengths. Okay? So what there's a natural thing that you can do with them in four dimensions, which is you can take the dual. So the dual is defined by T star mu nu is epsilon mu nu alpha beta 1/2 T alpha beta. And here I'm assuming that I have some metric eta mu nu, and so I raise these indices with the eta, these two indices here. Okay? And what I'm going to say holds for Lorentzian and Euclidean, since I want to follow, actually, these are, I told you I was following notes, I'm going to now assume Euclidean, and later we'll fix it up to be Lorentzian. So the metric is just 1, 1, 1, 1, like that. Okay? If I do it twice, then I get the same thing. And that's something which is true Euclidean, and for the Lorentzian case, there's a sign there. Okay. Now, basically, what this means is that T01 dual is T23, and so forth. So if you think that there are 6 degrees of freedom in T, then this mixes up the 6 degrees of freedom like this. Now, it's very convenient to consider taking T plus or minus its dual, and to call that T plus or minus. And the interesting thing is, the reason why we do that is that these are function-like eigenvectors under the duality. So if I take T plus or minus, and I take the dual, I get plus or minus T plus or minus. So this takes the 6 components of my anti-symmetric tensor and gives me 3 that go to themselves when I switch around 0, 1 for 2, 3, and so forth, and 3 that go to minus themselves. Okay. Now, the reason one does this is that what this implies, that you can split them up like this, is that the symmetry splits. The symmetry is SO4 in the case we're now Euclidean. And as a consequence of this, what happens, because all I've used is the epsilons, which are invariant under the SO4 transformation. So everything I've said has to be invariant under the SO4 transformation. But now, under something that's invariant under the SO4 transformation, I split things up into the T plus and the T minus, and each of those has 3 components. Each of those has just three components, because this one has the original T01 plus T23, etc. And this one has the T01. So say T01 is the original T01 plus T23, and here is T01 minus T23. So this has three independent components, and this has three independent components. And they are in different eigenspaces under this operation of taking the dual, which, however, is invariant under SO4. And that means that inside of it, SO4 has a structure which just mixes these three guys up, and another one which just mixes these three guys up. And if you think that through, you see that SO4 is actually two copies of SO3. This copy acts just on these three, treating them as a vector, which we call SO3 plus, and this transforms these, treating these as a vector. So this transforms the plus ones, leaves the zero, the minus ones fixed, and this SO3 transforms these, leaving these fixed. And this is a way to see, there are many ways to see this. You can also see it directly from the Lie algebra, which I think I'll do when I don't have 1 minute left. Okay. But this use of taking the dual, okay, corresponds to a simplification of the symmetry. Okay. And is there for a special structure in four dimensions, because the rotations in four dimensions are really two copies of rotations in three dimensions. Thank you. Okay. So that's my introduction to self-duality. Okay. What Amitabha Sen and Abhayashankar discovered is that if I do this to everything on the board, that as I do this to the omegas, and I do it also to these sigmas that I have up here, which are also anti-symmetric, okay, that the dynamics of the Einstein equations drastically simplifies and basically splits into two copies of a much simpler dynamics that is hidden inside the Einstein equations, because it's a gauge theory of the SO4 in the Euclidean case, but the SO4 is really two copies of the SO3. We can write the dynamics in such a way that we just have to think about one copy of the SO3. And the dynamics of the Einstein equation is simplified dramatically. And that's what they discovered, and that's what we're going to talk about next time.
What's wrong with the theory that we see that?
What's wrong with it?
Yeah.
Nothing. Nothing's wrong with it whatsoever. It's complicated. In particular, let me tell you what goes wrong. Supposing you decided to try to treat these omegas as the fundamental degree of freedom, the way that we've done. Okay, and follow through the Hamiltonian method as we've done it. Okay, what would you find, and what goes wrong? What goes wrong is that what you would find is that the different components of the omegas don't commute with each other under Poisson brackets. That they're very complicated commutation relations amongst the different components of omega. And that makes quantizing the theory very complicated, if you try to see it as a gauge theory with a function of the omegas. If I can anticipate, what they discovered is that when you split the omegas into these two parts, okay, these parts all commute with each other, and these parts all commute with each other, and all the complexity of the commutation relations comes from the plus part with the minus part. So if you want to see the theory in such a way that there's a configuration space which is a gauge field, you have to go down to this part. You have a choice. You can do it this one or this one. Okay. And then we'll see that explicitly next time.
I don't think it mixed up in general, actually, the dynamics.
No. They actually, the Einstein equations, they actually, well, yes. I've been talking here about the Euclidean case. Mm-hmm. In the Euclidean case, they decouple completely. In the Lorentzian case, there are some eyes around. And there are eyes here. And these are the complex conjugates of these.
And if you put matter, you actually break these?
No. No. That which is unexpected but also true. That is, you can put matter in such a way that you only ever have to refer to half. And I mean, I could go on and on. It's not actually very deep. I don't know that that's a deep property, but it was surprising. It's something that part of the physicist. So this plus and minus is totally.
It is surprising. I suppose you don't do any of these and you go back to that.
Yeah.
Do you see it there? Do you see it?
No. Okay. But let me speak against the original thing, okay? If we go back to the old-fashioned form of the Einstein equations, okay, now let's think about going to three space-time dimensions. In three space-time dimensions, everything on the blackboard is trivial, okay, because only the RABs, there's no curvature tensor except for the RABs because of some coincidences, okay? And everything simplifies. Okay? And in fact, the theory is trivial. Without matter. With matter, it's slightly less trivial. Okay? It took people, I'm not kidding, okay, it took people until 1989 to realize that the theory in three space-time dimensions was trivial. Okay? And that's an indication of how bad this notation is. No, it's from Weinberg's book that RAB equals zero implies RABCD equals zero. Okay. There were papers until 1989, okay, worrying quantizing this theory, okay, and claiming that it was divergent and undefinable, and it was non-renormalizable in perturbation theory, and had any pathology you could imagine.
Yeah, but there were solutions. People knew it was trivial. The classical solution.
People knew that the classical theory was trivial. Yeah. I'm not saying that, but the quantum theory was not realized. I mean, there was a literature about the quantum theory, even, you know, from Desert, Jacques, etc. They don't like to be reminded of it. They wrote lots of papers about it, which they didn't realize.
You're being filmed by it.
Sorry. But there was a literature, and the basic statement that the quantum theory was trivial, okay, was in a paper by some obscure Polish guy that nobody had ever heard of. Hidden in the proceedings of the Polish Academy of Sciences. Okay, and so there was a paper for torus topology. No, I'm sorry, for trivial topology. I think for a plane and a sphere, he found that the quantum theory was completely trivial and it was just one state. Okay, but nobody was aware of that paper, and the fact that the quantum theory was completely trivial was not realized until 1989, when it was translated into this notation, in which case it's the theory that we already discussed. I haven't shown that, but it was the theory. From what I've done today, you could easily show that now. And I will go back and do that. So another way to say it is that people usually try to get to the quantum theory either through perturbation theory, in which case, I mean, once you know that your job is to show that it's trivial in perturbation theory, you realize that the theory is one loop finite, and that was done by Singer and Axelrod, you know, in 1989 point something, right away. But it hadn't been done before. another thing that has not been done is, you know, the Hamiltonian people who tried to get to the quantum theory through the Hamiltonian theory were looking at this Arnowitz, Desmond-Misner formulation. And so far as I know, it looks, you know, it looks just as complicated in 2 plus 1 as 3 plus 1 in terms of the metric variables. And even if you know that RAB equals 0 implies RABCD equals 0, that's not enough to really show that that theory is trivial from the Hamiltonian point of view.
So you're using the metric as a dynamical variable.
Yeah. And roughly, I mean, roughly speaking, the reason why it's hard is that even if RABCD equals 0, if you slice it, you can make your slices look like they have intrinsically lots of curvature and extrinsically lots of curvature in such a way that actually everybody cancels because there's no space-time curvature. But if you see things in terms of slices with geometry evolving, okay, it looks very untrivial. And again, whereas if you see things in terms of connection variables, okay, no matter how you slice it, it's still true that the annulus field is 0. So, I'm not just gossiping, I'm not just telling you. There will be, we will spell all these things out.